This is the Liam Sheff Show on UCY-TV and Truth Frequency Radio.
Seem to grasp the idea that that whole concept is Looney Tunes, no pun intended, but I mean it is.
Totally. We got Liam Sheff on the line. Liam, are you there? Can you hear me?
I am here. Oh. Sorry, just unmuting the mic. I am here.
Oh, okay, right on. So you've looked into this whole flat Earth theory to some length. What's your take on this, Liam?
I look into it, and I continue to look into it because.
Right.
I believe that it is the most important scientific discovery of... Okay, I'm kidding. So...
Oh, my God. No, I was...
All right. Well, so
I was like, what?
Okay, so... sorry, I had to do that. So I chapter 9 of my book is on astronomy. I've been a very amateur astronomer since I was a kid. I wrote some reports on it. I did some studies, and I lost interest in astronomy when Stephen Hawking and those guys sort of took it over with fake numbers and, you know, invented string theory, alternative universe, because you can't observe any of that stuff and it's not real. And there are huge problems with what NASA proposes. I don't know if we'll have time in a segment to do it, but I could come back on and tell you about it. The universe out there is plasma. It's electrical. The electrical force dominates the universe, but NASA is very much stuck in a 17th century model. Isaac Newton was 17th century, in which there's very nothing strong in outer space. There's no strong attractive or repulsive force. So NASA has to invent things like black holes. Those don't exist. That's a mathematical construction to explain what you see out there. Now, along comes the flat Earth. There are problems with the NASA Sun model. It's not a nuclear bomb going off in space. It looks more like an electric anode being heated through currents enveloping the thing, and I can explain more of what I mean. So But here come the flat Earth people. Now, they've been around for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, by the way, who say that the world is flat. It's actually in the Torah that there's this thing called Sheol, and there are seven heavens and a number of hells. And, you know, it's pure mythology. Okay, so when you start talking to flat Earth people, the first thing, as Don was suggesting, that happens is you're blinkered by the fact that they are actually taking it seriously. And now I got into a fight with a number of very good friends of mine. We've patched
like
it up.
Like a fist fight?
Oh, no. We're... No,
did you throw a propane tank in a fire?
Yes, a propane tank in a firefight. We were sitting around the fire, and my friend's daughter, or my son's daughter... No, we were sitting around their living room, and they just came at me with this thing, and they said, oh, have you heard flat Earth theory? And I just shrugged my shoulders like, come on. And they said, no, really, you have to look into it. And I thought, okay... Whatever you're smoking, stop smoking it. So we talked for the next 2.5 hours until I had sussed out from them that they presented me the model of the flat. Because if you're going to be a scientist, you have to have the model of the thing. What does it look like? Well, it's a frisbee. It's the UN flag. Antarctica is encircling the globe. Now, in order to prove this even, you know, probably incorrect, all you have to do is say, please explain the moon. The moon looks like a sphere that's illuminated by a light source that's at a particular angle to it. That sphere is going around another sphere and then being cast in shadow for periods. Anyway, you can make the moon work with three balls. One's a light, one's the Earth, and one's the moon. The way that the flat earthers want to make it work is to say that magically a holographic moon that's illuminated by, you know, whatever, appears to go through the transit cycle that perfectly emulates...
Wait a minute. So they're saying the moon is a hologram?
Well, no, it's a bulb. It's an artifact of the upper heavens created by the thing that created us. Now, let's look at Mars and Venus. You can see Mars and Venus through binoculars. You can see them with the naked eye, but you can really see them with good binoculars. And then with a kid's telescope, you can see them better. Now, the flat earthers argue that the planets going around the sun are actually fairies or some sort of light up in the upper ether, under the dome. Oh, I'm sorry. Did I not mention? There's a crystalline dome, some sort of, you know, lavender rock dome of some sort above us. Of course there is.
Of some sort.
They don't have the details, but it's a very important area of research for them. And to do research...
Who needs details?
Well, they go on every site online that's showing anything from a satellite, anything astronomical at all, and they say, ha, 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 this looks like Avatar. Ha, 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 these are good computer graphics.
Jeez.
I've been told
that everything by these guys, that every picture that has ever been published from NASA is fake, that it's not real. Everything.
Yes, everything's... So because... And this is the basic problem with an illogical argument, and, you know, just pure Aristotelian logic. If A is a cat, then everything is a cat. You know, if NASA lies once... then everything they say is a lie. So if the moon landing was a hoax, that means that no rockets have ever launched from Cape Canaveral. Sorry, I've seen rockets launch from Cape Canaveral. I mean, there are just too many eyewitnesses to rockets launching. No, they just go over the horizon and crash in the endless sea. Do they? Or, well, the space shots that we see footage of, that's just like Star Wars. You can tell it's CGI, except that they're moving cameras on these things at periods that there wasn't CGI. You know, except that the footage from outer space actually tracks the development of better cameras and technology, so we see more the better the technology gets. But we, you know, it's pretty okay. Oh, NASA admits that to take a long picture of the Earth, I mean, sorry, a collected picture of the entire surface of the Earth, they have to knit together and use Photoshop. Well, yeah.
I'm playing the Coast to Coast theme in the background while you're talking. I figured we needed some conspiracy music.
Well, if you have a little bug, let's say you have a little fly, a gnat, and it's flying around your head pretty close, and it has a little gnat camera, and it's taking pictures, it's only going to get a square inch or two at a time, and that's what satellites do going around our very large planet. So, yeah, you have to knit them together to create an assembled whole. And, oh, it's fake. I guess it's...
Yeah, it just goes on, and you can't talk reason with some people. Stick around after the break here, Liam. We'll talk a little bit more about this. Mike, and Super Don on American Elk Radio. We'll be back with Liam Shep after this.
Hey, the bastard child, the bastard stepchild of the failure of the 9/11 movement to be taken seriously. And they should have been taken seriously. They have good research. They were very earnest. But you can disprove flat Earth theory by watching something disappear over the horizon if you go to the shore. You can disprove it by getting into an actual debate where you define your terms with anybody and ask them to show you the model of the flat Earth and then to test it in any way.
I wouldn't even argue with somebody like that. I would just walk away. I mean, I have no time or tolerance for stupidity like that.
No, you're you're more practical. You're smarter. But it's occupying people on the internet, which is a huge mistake. So I've tried to point out to them that there is a better scientific to use that word, a better testable theory. It's called plasma physics or electric universe theory, which actually does correct a lot of NASA's mistakes without going back into time to Sheol and the Torah for scientific information.
Yeah. Listen, Liam, we got to let you go. We got other stuff to get to, but thanks for coming on the show once again. We'll definitely have you back. So.
Let's think through this for a moment. What is the most stable form of government in history? We have a few choices. Democracy. Let's see. Aristocracy. Tyranny. Oh, monarchy, of course. Monarchy. Let's think out loud. We're supposedly a democracy. We're holding an election. We're running these various people for office who are, of course, funded by large corporations. They have to be. They have to get hundreds of thousands of dollars from any particular large corporation. We consider this a democracy. It really feels like an oligarchy, rule of a few powerful. So we're not quite a democracy. Are we a stable form of government? If we're not a democracy, and we've already devolved into an oligarchy, in which huge corporations, all running on vast quantities of oil, actually give us two people to vote for,
then they might as well give us one person to vote for. There's really no significant difference between two and one, is there? Not really. So we're living in an oligarchy, an illusion of a democracy. There have been very few democracies on Earth. There have been many, many monarchies. There have been a few tyrannies. I'd like to talk about that, and I think that the answer as to what kind of government is the most stable will surprise you, but it may also make sense, and it may make sense of the farce that we're living in. My name's Liam Schaff. My book is Official Stories. 10 topics, 11 chapters, CIA, JFK, vaccination, 9/11, HIV, Big Bang, Shakespeare, Darwinism, plate tectonics, and more for the low, low price of about $12, I think, and $3 or $4 on Kindle. This is American Heretic, funded by you. Put a couple dollars into the PayPal. If you ask the question, what is the most stable form of government on Earth, you'd simply have to look at the history and record books. The government that had lasted the longest, in all places, for all time, you would have to say was the most stable form of government. We can also ask the question, what is the most stable form of an economic system or of a social organizational system that has ever occurred? We can look through history, and we find precious few of anything that we call a democracy in which all of the people in the society, thank you, mouth, were able to vote. Voting in most societies is limited to landowning males. So if we're a democracy, but we only allow landowning males to vote, then we're not really a democracy. What are we? A thing that fell off the bed? Possibly. But we may also be, well, let's think about it, an oligarchy, an aristocracy. If we're dependent on a very few people who own a lot of property to vote for an even smaller group of people who are mostly given to us by oligarchs, then we are an oligarchy or an aristocracy that makes a kind of fun vote or a rotten vote for the very few people who represent the interests that are already in charge. It doesn't sound like democracy. Now, demos and krasi is rule of the people, and res publica is rule of the people. So democracies and republics are in word the same thing and in practice the same thing, because the Athenian democracy was the voting of the very few wealthy landowning men in a society in which slaves, women, and children didn't exist. They had no political rights at all. Women were slaves to the house, slaves were servants to anybody who owned them, and children had no particular rights to speak of until they came of a certain age, if they were male. If not, too bad, get pregnant and stay in the house. In Sparta, women had some role in the society that was greater than the role of Athenian women, but that whole society was dependent on the helots, groups of cities that had been subdued through extraordinary violence all around Sparta, that had a yearly cyclical war waged on them to kill all of the strongest people so they wouldn't uprise. So Sparta was an entirely a slave culture that didn't worry about voting. They went to war when they wanted to. There's an apocryphal, it's probably apocryphal, it's probably not actually accurate, that was a line that was written with your shield or on it, meaning come back from a battle with your shield or on it. In other words, go big or go home? Go big or die, essentially, was the Spartan motto. At least that's what they emblazoned on their crest. And then you look at the story of the 300 who fought at Thermopylae, not a democratic 300, just guys who had time to train, gym bunnies, you know, who went to the gym all the time and savored the taste of their own and other people's blood. It's a great heroic story, but not told in the story are all the slaves that attended them and all the other people who were there during the Battle of Thermopylae who just weren't part of that 300. There were plenty of people there. And it was, I guess, a great battle if you think murder, death, suicide are great. It was an important battle in separating the idea of Persian from the idea of the Eastern from the Western states. But it was not a democratic battle. It was just a battle between warring aristocracies, oligarchies, slave-owning nations. Let's jump ahead to the Roman Empire. It's a great empire. We are modeled most closely on the Roman Empire. If Athens is England, then Rome is America. Money was the most important thing. Money was the most important god. Sound familiar? Did they vote? A little. You could be a landowning person and get into a voting class. You weren't counted for very much. You could be a high-ranking military officer and get into the voting class, or you could just be a wealthy, rich white guy, essentially, whatever the color of the skin was, and get into the Roman Senate. in which case you went along with what the presiding emperor, or, well, for a while they didn't have an emperor, they had two guys who would sit there and sort of handle the vote, and then you had to do what was in the economic best interest of Rome. And eventually there was a guy who said, we don't need two, we'll just need one. His name was Julius Caesar, and he wasn't the first. There was Marius and Sulla. There were all kinds of problems in the ancient Roman world that belie the idea that it was any kind of democracy. It was, though, a system with competitive different agencies in charge of the state. And so we get our tripartite republic. We have our judicial and our, the name escapes me. I know, I should know. But we have our tripartite head of government between the Supreme Court, the Congress, and the Senate, congressional and the Senate. So we have this three houses that compete with each other to make votes that support the wealthy landowners who want to go to war with all the brown-skinned people who own the oil. Mostly, though, we're still an oligarchy serving the purpose of the energy state, the oil state. That's what Rome had to do. They got their food from Egypt, so they had to make sure that they had enough of a military to maintain their dominance and hegemony over Egypt so that they could farm the Nile and get the food to Rome, because they were shipping their food in from ancient Monsanto land. It wasn't genetically modified, but it was totally dependent on the Nile. And when Rome fell apart, in many ways, it was because their ability to hold that hegemony fell apart. Now, let's jump forward to the English Parliament, and I think that's worth talking about, because England has just left the European Union, and the European Union is the continued idea of bureaucratizing all human processes. Now, this is a terrible, terrible idea that you see in little from the smallest little kibbutzes and collectives, hippie collectives, to the largest governments. You see these people getting together thinking that if they get together in rooms and talk about shit for a long time, that that somehow represents freedom or democracy or whatever. Democracy is rule of the rich people, so what does it really recommend? The European Union is an artificial state entity based in, I think, Brussels, that's in the and around the UN, that's really based in the idea that we've had enough oil to sort of tame international differences and to put a Starbucks and a McDonald's in every country on earth that has enough oil or enough resources to trade with the oil-rich nations of the world, or to have a gun put to their head so that they hand over their coffee for a reasonable price on the free market so that they can participate in things like the G8 and the G20. It's a lot of air quotes, but you understand what I mean. Let's pull the gun away from the head. We don't want to be in one of those countries. We're in the country with the guns. Yay, we're America. So did medieval England know they had a king? And they were stable for a long time. And if you really think about it, the Romans, who had an emperor and a senate, really had a king. And the king had to deal with the senate, and the senate had to deal with some of the people, only in the sense, though, that you had enough entertainment and food for the people. Ah, now we're coming to it. If there's not enough food and enough distraction, the people tend to go crazy. And people are not very smart. We like some TNA, we like some violence in the arena, and we like to have free bread. And if it's not free, it shouldn't cost more than a package of Little Debbie snack cakes at the 7-Eleven. Not very much money, or at the Walmart. That'll fill you up, give you diabetes, AIDS, and cancer, but don't worry about that, because you're full, and that's the most important thing about being human. You can be deceived and tricked into anything by having a bread and circus, a circum, what do you call it? Not a Panera, don't worry about that kind of thing. No. What you want is the Circus Maximus. You want a gladiatorial battle to give you enough bloodlust and bloodletting. You want a football match in which the hooligans can run riot and really let go of their hatred of the opposite team. You know, I'm LIVERPOOL, you know, all the way. You got to fight, fight, fight. For what? You don't know. You're just fighting because people are kind of crazy. People are kind of crazy. So are we a democracy? Of course not. You don't want most people to vote. They're crazy. They're voting. They're screaming about people not making a goal with a pigskin bladder down the... Who cares? It's irrelevant. But they're going nuts. They're absolutely out of their minds. And if we made it, that was a bad call, ref. And the people are down there going crazy. And if they have enough food to stuff into their gobbers, you know, if they just have enough food to put in there and enough to scream about, people are happy. That's happiness for the human species. It's mental illness, but it's human happiness. Now, the people on top are managing the resources, going, we have to have enough food for the poor people, or they'll go crazy and try to kill us and put our heads on pikes. The people in charge aren't in charge of free energy, Tesla energy, that kind of thing. They're just in charge of saying, we got to maintain this, so we have to go to war with them to make sure that we have enough stuff coming in, that we can produce enough free food, cheap food, to keep the Little Debbie in the Walmart so that poor people can go in and go, this is pretty good. Why am I sick all the time? I don't know. It's nothing to eat. You're a conspiracy theorist. Are we a democracy, a monarchy, an aristocracy, or a tyranny? Now, tyranny is what happens when that energy level goes very, very low, and the people start going, we're agitating. Then the tyrant comes in and goes, you people have to shut up or I'll kill you all. That's tyrant. That's all a tyrant is. It's a monarch, an oligarch, or even a king. Even a president who is in a nation in which resources are becoming very scarce. Tyranny must come to face the angry crowd that just wants more Little Debbie snack cakes and some violence in the arena. So then you hire fools and sellouts and people just trying to make it, I guess, who happen to be get off on beating up other people to be the militia, you know, to keep down the populace, to be the armed guards that secure the rightful honor of the king and that sort of thing. They buy into that. I'm a Marine. I serve the POTUS. I believe all this shit. What? If there's enough food, the people don't riot. If there's not enough food, people riot. All you are is an armed security guard for the President of the United States. Now, what? We've left England, where we have a prime minister who is not very prime and not much of a minister. We can see during the Brexit exit that he can say anything he wants, and the poor people go, we don't like the Muslims. We're voting our way out. And they vote their way out. What? We blame everything on the Pakis. That's a good curry. Oh, we're getting out of this arrangement. We're tired of you UN gobs. We're tired of you slobs. We want out. We want our own, like the good old days of Maggie Thatcher and before that. Don't you remember the good old days of Maggie Thatcher and before that? You don't remember all that stuff? No, you don't. Because you were born, you came up in the 90s. And in the 90s, you had free energy coming in from the North Sea. You had a huge amount of oil coming in from the North Sea where you built the giant dildo downtown and that stupid windmill that people get on, whatever that is, that Ferris wheel. And Pierce Brosnan was 007. It was very expensive as opposed to the old cheap movies. Things changed because you had a lot of oil. And you think that if you just vote your way out of a system that is pointless, being involved in the UN, that you'll be more free. You're going to fight among yourselves. You're going to have internal race riots and race wars because the poor people voted and poor people don't like other poor people from other countries. It's a fact. Look up this thing called history. Who do you get to fight with the other poor people? Your poor people. Hey, look, their skin color is a little different. They have a spot over here and you have a spot over here. They don't believe in Jeebus and they believe in Huba and you have to go fight them. Go fight them. Do it. What's the most efficient form of government on earth? There, of course, is none. The efficient form of government is totally determined by the amount of energy in the society. If you have a very high energy society, it's very easy to pretend to be a democracy. All you do is you give the wealthier people, the landowning males, the right to vote. And they go, we're in favor of land and being men. We love being in charge. Shut up, brown-skinned woman. It's not complicated. If you become a very rich country in which you don't even have to have the brown-skinned slaves doing the work for you, we're so great, we liberated you brown-skinned slaves because we had enough oil. What? No, we're liberal. We're liberal. And you gay people, take AIDS drugs. They won't kill you. So we're really very, very liberated because we had enough oil. We had Texas oil, we had California oil, we had Oklahoma oil, and we had Saudi oil. We can do everything we want to be as liberal as we want. What's our form of government? Fake democracy. It's going to be ground down into, you guessed it, tyranny, because we're going to be running lower on oil. That's all it is. History is a systole and diastole. It's a teeter-totter between extremes. When you have enough, you can pretend to be good and liberal and holy. When you don't, you're bad and tyrannical and against freedom. So that's it. That's the answer. Where are we headed? We're already a monarchy. Come on. Trumpery? They're one person. They're a cross-dressing thing with a strap-on dildo. I don't know what it is. I don't want to be involved. The hair itself is scary on both of them. So I don't vote because it's not a system that really requires me to vote. If we run low on energy, we're just fucked and we're going to end up in a tyrannical state. We're really a monarchy with a group of oligarchs pretending to vote for stuff. You want to see a good movie? Go watch The Big Short. It's really good. It'll tell you that nothing matters. Nothing at all. Wall Street is a giant Ponzi scheme in a game waiting to crash because there's no such thing as voting. What we have is either enough oil or too little oil. You want to see what too little oil looks like? Go visit Syria. Have a great time. Venezuela's waiting for your vacation dollars. I hope you like cat. I mean to eat. My name's Liam Sheff. This is American Heretic. Put a couple dollars into the PayPal if you enjoyed this message of actual geopolitical honesty. See you next time. A nice woman on Facebook was commenting on my recent video about vaccines and moms, which I ended by saying that we were going to have to relocalize and look after each other in small groups without authority or permission from above, because there was really no way out of it. There's no way out for a nation of parents with damaged children to get the government to fix it for you. And there's no way of housing ourselves in single-family homes in which we have the support and resources in a dwindling, declining economy to make all of that work without having other people around. And she said something like, you know, he makes good points, but there are other options. And I said, well, he's right here, and, you know, what are the other options? And she posted something about a car that runs on water. Now, I need to talk about this because there are a lot of people who are infected by this way of thinking, and I think that this is an infection of the human mind that has always existed, so it's not possible to root it out, only to recognize it. I'm going to call it the H virus, the H-O-P virus, or the hope virus, and I'd like to talk about the hope virus and how we have to face it and overcome it very quickly, or, well, I'll talk about that too. My name's Liam Sheff. My book is Official Stories. This is American Heretic, funded by you. If you learned something, hear something interesting or challenging that makes you think hard, please put a couple dollars into the PayPal. This isn't free to do. Human species. You can recognize the human species, and we should define what we mean by the human species by looking at our report card. Our report card is called history. So first, let's define the human species and look at history. Then let's look at the thing that has changed the way that we see ourselves. And finally, let's talk about that water-powered car. So first, history. History is a record of us, our needs, our wants, and our behaviors over thousands, tens of thousands, or even hundreds of thousands of years. You can trace the human species through time, looking at archaeological sites, a great deal of evidence, and then, of course, the history of writing and recorded history and civilization. What do you see? You see a mammalian species that gives live birth. We should not discount ourselves from thinking of ourselves like a kind of mammal or animal on planet Earth. Yes, we're a talking, tool-making animal with a reflective consciousness so that we're aware that we're aware. Does anything else separate us from animals? It's a long fight that you can have to no avail because you'll get hungry at a certain point, which only makes the point that you are a mammal, an animal, a life form on planet Earth. We are then defined by our hunger and our thirst, by our storytelling, and by our tool-making. It is our tool-making, and we're not the only tool-makers. There are apes and chimps and monkeys and, well, plenty of animals make tools, including crows. We're just distinguishable at the level of acuity and excellence of our tool-making. We can say, though, that the tools that we make can very easily destroy us. We then can note that our ability to make tools and to reasonably manage the effects of those tools is far, I should say, underserved by our ability to recognize the effects. So if I said that backwards, I apologize. We can do great damage. We can do more than we have a rational understanding of. The nuclear bomb should clue you into that. Glyphosate, most pesticides, DDT, most pharmaceuticals should clue you into the idea that we can do things, we can make things, the internal combustion engine, that have severe consequences for our well-being. But we don't think that far ahead. There's a reason for it. I'll get to that in the second part. So we're a human mammal on Earth. The most important thing to us, of course, is, of course, food and water, but we don't think that way. We think money is the most important thing. That's a product of, well, late civilization. I'll talk about that. But food is the most important thing. All early civilization worshipped a god in the form of their leader. So the pharaoh, the emperor, any leader of any ancient world was associated with the food source. So worshipping the pharaoh in ancient Egypt meant that you were worshipping the sun coming up and down around the world and worshipping the flooding of the Nile because you needed the Nile to flood so that you could produce food. Your worship of the pharaoh was a kind of stand-in. And then you can see that human beings always need the stand-in and very quickly forget that they're worshipping a stand-in for nature. And they put that as a god. That's why religion is all hokum and bullshit. It's a bunch of stories written by people just like us who worship Iron Man, Spider-Man, Superman, and other shit that they make up. And we enjoy entertaining stories. It's not true. There are no magicians in the past who don't exist today. And there's no magic that could have been done in the human species like levitating or coming back from the dead or turning one fish into a lot of fish. These are great stories, the same way Iron Man is an interesting story that represents the petroleum state in the military-industrial state. So Spider-Man represents the state of science, of atomic fears. Godzilla represents atomic fears, the Incredible Hulk atomic fears. You can see how the human mind takes a current fascination or science or something that it doesn't understand and posits that, anthropomorphizes that onto a character. So the ancient Egyptians worshipped the pharaoh, so the Japanese worshipped the emperor. So we worship oil. It is oil that we worship, because oil is what gives us our food. We'll get to that. The human species is a storytelling creature that worships in a positive aspect something that represents nature. It then worships in negative aspects something that it can scapegoat. Usually in Christianity, the Jews have been the scapegoat, and then the Muslims are the other scapegoat, which is ironic because we all stem, anybody in this Western project has a lineage in the same set of strange Levantine beliefs that come out of Palestine, that come out of herding cultures, that really just represent a small tribal way of life that was absorbed by the Roman Empire and metamorphosed through Greek influence into the idea of Christianity, which was then frankly raped and destroyed by the Roman bureaucrats and turned into Catholicism, which is where we all descend from. So we all worship totems. We have taboos. We are a human species. We are pugnacious. We are acquisitive. We need to eat every day. We worship a god that is not a real god, but is a metamorphosed version, a humanized version of what nature really is. Now, let's move on. What changed in the 20th, 19th century? What changed? We would still be that species worshiping a god that represented the harvest, if not for one thing. In 1859, oil being discovered in large volume in Titusville, Pennsylvania. Oil changed everything. Coal had changed everything to some degree before, because we were able to move people more quickly and make more stuff using coal. But if we hadn't discovered oil, we wouldn't be able to grow food the way that we do. We wouldn't have been able to populate the planet the way that we do. We now have giant bulls, giant animals called super tractors, harvesting and planting and suffusing all the land with anhydrous ammonium, which is an oil byproduct. We have oil in everything that we eat, everything that we wear. Go to any of your stores and walk down the aisle and do a mental trick of winding it back to its source. Wind it back to its source and you'll see that it comes from petroleum. Any plastic, any metal comes from petroleum. The metals have been mined from bauxite and iron and then heated and changed and altered with petroleum, then shipped to us by petroleum. So those you know are oil. Now look at food. Food is shipped on large petroleum-carrying vessels that are made of petroleum, made by petroleum, and filled with petroleum to run. The food itself is grown in dead land. We've killed most of the land. We then spray it with anhydrous ammonium, which is natural gas, which is suffused with more nitrogen, which we spray on the dead soil to get plants to grow, because we need to suffuse it with nitrogen to get it to grow. We're eating petroleum. You didn't know that. We don't learn this in school. But our current god that we worship, and the human species has always worshipped an idol, is oil. But we don't know that we worship oil, so we think that we worship politics, and we think we're a political animal, and we think that we're free by voting for a bunch of gods of petroleum. Trumpery, Hillary, Bernery, they're all petroleum gods. Obama E was a petroleum god. Bush, petroleum god, straight out. Straight up gangsta, petroleum god. All of the Bushes. Clinton, petroleum god. He's the one who, you know, handled the NAFTA stuff so that we could ship things very far away. We're worshiping a god of petroleum anywhere we go. We don't see it, so we disguise it from ourselves, the way the Egyptians disguised worshiping the sun as the pharaoh, barely disguised it, but disguised it, the way that anybody ever worshipped any god disguised, nature disguised as any god, the way that Jesus is a sun god, you know, representing the death and the winter and the rebirth and the spring. Come on, look into it a little bit. This isn't history. This is nature manifested as anthropomorphized, hopeful, whatever, theology, so that we feel psychologically that we have some management of our universe, which we don't have any management of at all. Now, back to this conversation I was having. Somebody there, nice person, I'm sure, on Facebook, with good intentions, posted something on a video saying, well, we have alternatives to oil. We use approximately 19 million barrels of oil per day in this country. We use approximately 19 million barrels of oil per day in this country alone, about 90, 95 million per day worldwide, not per year, per day. Do you really think that the Earth is just magically producing 95 million barrels of oil per day and making it easy to get just because the human species discovered oil in 1859? We've burned through Titusville long ago. Spindletop is long dry. But here's the hope virus, the H virus. It gets in the way. And because we have an internet that we don't really have to pay much for, and because we grew up with abundant food, people think that they're owed abundant food. The way that the Egyptians thought that the Nile would flood the same way forever, the way that the ancient Athenians thought theirs was the greatest society that had ever existed, but again, one out of four or one out of three of them, depending on whose numbers you believe, in ancient Athens were slaves. The great birthplace of democracy was a slave state of the most brutal nature. Below, in the south, Sparta, never considered a birthplace of democracy but lionized in movies like the 300, was a state that kept waged constant eugenic warfare on cities around it, killing the strongest so that they wouldn't uprise, so that the Spartans would have a slave force to grow its food, so that it could be that militaristic state that we think so well of when Gerard Butler flashes his smile and shows his abs. The world has been built on slavery. We now build the world on oil and petroleum. We use 19 million barrels of that per day. A barrel of oil is 5.8 million British thermal units. It's about 42 gallons. It's worth about 10 to 15,000 hours of human labor, which is about 5 to 7 years of a day job. One barrel of oil is worth 5 to 7 years of 8-hour days, 5 days a week. Or about year and a half to 2 years of 20, well, year and a half of 24-hour round-the-clock steady work without interruption. We do then, in terms of a day job, think about it, close to 20 million barrels of oil per day, times at the low end 5 years of work per barrel. We do about 100 million barrel years of work per day. And we don't see it, and we don't think that oil is our god. And we think that it's easily replaceable and that there's such a thing as a car that runs on water. Last part of this talk. There are no cars that run on water. This is one of the problems with not, well, of a little information being a dangerous thing and the hope virus getting in the way. If you see these blog posts about free energy being suppressed, you need to go a lot deeper and understand how energy is produced. If you see blog posts about Tesla energy saving us all, you have to understand that we use Tesla energy. It's called the dynamo and the generator. We use it all the time. Tesla's machines are used every day, all the time. It runs on motion, so you either have to use something like Niagara Falls, which is how he powered his non-free energy machines, or you have to boil water, which means you have to burn coal, oil, or natural gas, or do something outrageously stupid like using nuclear power to spin the wheel to make the electricity. Yes, there's a little bit of solar. Those things are expensive to make. You make them overseas in Chinese factories. They're getting a little cheaper. They're getting a little more efficient, but not at the rate of 19 million barrels per day. There is no car that runs on water. Doesn't exist. There are cars that can run on hydrogen or oxyhydrogen, H2O2. But in order to get water to be split into hydrogen, you have to zap it with a strong bolt of electricity, which means you have to store that in a battery, which is made of heavy metals that you mine in countries whose citizens you murder and destroy to get to their mines. Hi, Venezuela. Hi, Bolivia. And oil that you steal by enslaving entire populations and waging wars for victory and peace and democracy on people who we've liberated from their bodies, souls, and skin. So maybe their children have a reason for not liking us that much. No, they just hate our freedom, don't they? We worship a god called oil, and the hope virus gets in the way of seeing that because we've never lived in a world without oil. But we're going to live in a world with less oil. Not no oil, but less oil. And it's going to hurt. And it gets in the way of our seeing how we're going to have to live, which is locally, in communities, not single-family homes. We're going to have to build solar together. We're going to have to put aside differences, including ridiculous religious differences, because religion is the worship of an ancient sun god that we thought would give us grain. We can stop it any time we want. Maybe we should worship the actual sun for a change. That would probably be a better way to go. But knowing human beings, we'd fuck that up somehow. My name is Liam Sheff. My book is Official Stories. This is American Heretic. I will continue to talk about this until you're sick of hearing about it. You need to be relocalizing where you live. Stop worrying about your religion or if the government's going to make you share something with somebody. All of you YouTube crybabies telling me how the government will take your guns out of your hand over your long dead body. You're just making a prophecy. Stop it. Decide to get along with people. Decide that you can share with your neighbors and decide to grow things together and keep yourself alive in small groups that aren't wildly religiously associated, but are rather bound around the practical ideas of helping the infirm live and survive by giving people real skills that mean something and by growing food and procuring water together. Or, hello, Dark Ages, I bow to the Pharaoh, the sun god, because he is the god of all things and I worship the overflow of the river. Your choice. There are many methods of control that are used on us so that we're reliant on a system in which we really cannot... There are many methods of control used on us that we participate in willingly, that we really volunteer for, even though they tend to enslave us. I'd like to talk about two of those systems of control. They're well-known terms. One is church, and the other is state. My name is Liam Sheff. My books are Official Stories, Truth About Love. My movies are The Oil Alarm and Surviving Sidhu. This is American Heretic, funded by you. Find the PayPal link, please. Church is something that people grow up with. Church is a series of ideas about a magic set of people, superhero stories, exciting stuff for kids to think about. Occasionally we're told that these are morally important tales. You know, if you believe in something that you can't see, the lions won't eat you, or if you have the right God on your side instead of the wrong God on your side, then you can kill all the children of somebody else or cut all the tips of the penises off a lot of people. It's in the Torah. It's a lot of messy stuff, and we're told that somehow it's morally edifying. I don't know. I grew up reading Greek myths, and I was exposed to Bible stuff side by side with Greek and Roman and other myths, so they appeared to me to be what they are, which are mythic stories, you know, tribal stories, dressed up in the superhero guises that we, you know, dress up things that we don't really understand. It helps us remember things when we make somebody a superhero. But religion claims to be a moral guidepost for people. They get stuck, if the Torah or Talmud are too messy for people, and the Torah and Talmud are too messy for most people to take literally. Rabbinical Jews certainly don't take it literally. They sit and debate and debate and debate and debate what anything right might mean. And they could just as well debate, as I've said before, Dickens or Shakespeare or Edward de Vere, if you want to go that way. They could debate... They could debate any really good, reasonably good writer with a moral compass. They could debate Hawthorne or Melville, frankly, better than they could, or as well as they could, material from the Old Torah and Pentateuch. Or they could take Ovid's Metamorphoses or the Odyssey, the Iliad, very important books when you want to talk about ethics and morality. But we're stuck with this crazy Bible thing. And then, of course, if you're Islamic, you're stuck with your crazy version of something that was supposedly written by somebody in a trance. These things, though, stick with us when we become adults. We don't have critical thinking as kids, not really. That's why it's so easy to lie to kids about, like, Santa Claus or Easter Bunny. It's an insane thing that we do, to lie to children about something, only to sort of break their hearts for no reason at all, except to tell them the world is a totally deceptive place. Adults have the same relationship with Jesus that children have with Santa Claus. They, you know, don't require any evidence. They believe in it, and so they get presents at Christmas because they go buy them, because they work at a slave job, a job that they tend to hate, with people that they tend to only barely tolerate, suppressing every other thought they have in their mind for fear of upsetting, well, the person who's supposed to be their moral guidepost. So you can see that a relationship with religion is messy business. Most people aren't fundamentalists. They're not religious literalists. You know, they only accept the little bit that they read, they interpret it, they throw a lot away. There's a problem with Christianity in America, by the way, and it's that Christianity is anything you want it to be. You know, it's anything that you decide that it is and everything that you decide it isn't. And, oh, they didn't mean that. That's just what they wrote back then. But the true message, you say, according to you, which really should indicate that you have your own moral center and you just reflect it off of the tiniest portion of some book that you found or you were forced to read as a kid. You don't actually need the book. Dumbo, you don't need the feather to fly. You could use any feather because you actually fly because of your giant elephant wings. Well, you know what I mean. You have a moral center and ethics because you do. Because that's what human animals have, unless they're deranged narcopaths. But religion gets us, and it says that if we don't follow these things and believe these things, which are totally self-conflicted, so totally self-contradicting, and if we don't believe we're going to a bad place, we don't want to say out loud that we don't really believe it, because all our neighbors say they believe it, and if they believe it, we have to believe it, or they don't let our kids like play with it, and we need a babysitter sometimes, so we just say, yeah, special testicles and watch, or shalom, or whatever we end up saying, Allah Akbar. You know, Salaam Alaikum, sorry, not Allah Akbar, but Salaam Alaikum. And maybe you say these things because, like, well, my father said these things, and my mother would be upset if I didn't say these things. Mothers are upset by a lot of things. Mothers are, well, they're very emotional creatures, not always basing their decisions in life on true logic, you know, having suffered the scorn of their mother and father for a long time, having been slut-shamed in their youth, having been married very young, having all of their fantasies told where the devil's strings being pulled and they're just a little puppet, so they have to hide. So mothers aren't always, especially very old-fashioned mothers, aren't always the best people to go through to for a refined, considered, well-balanced psychological reading, interpretation of what society is. But there we go. We don't want to upset mom, just like she didn't want to upset mom, just like she didn't want to upset mom, just like she didn't want to upset mom, who really didn't want to upset dad. And then nobody stops and says, is this thing that we're worshiping, this ancient collection of Hebrew Judaic monster stories and parables, whatever its source, you know, I mean, whether it was mythologizing stuff that was happening in space or whatever, does anybody ever really say, do we really want to live our lives by superhero stories, or can we find a more rational, inclusive basis that doesn't include lobbing off the skin of our wankers or, you know, doing something terrible to somebody at some point that they don't want to have done because it was done to me, by gum, and it's going to be done to you. Look at me, I turned out fine. I'm so tired of hearing that. Look at me, I turned out fine. I only hate blah, 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 blah. There's somebody on my page the other day just going on and on and on and on about something. Somebody posted something about the Ten Commandments and said, see, these are your rules. It says, thou shalt not kill. And he posted back, oh, no, there's a difference between murder and kill. Okay, bye, go away. We decide anything that we want that suits our own irrational view of the world, and we take from the outside and we adhere to it. And that's the problem with religion, is it gives a lot of bad ideas a kind of authority, a gravitas. Well, it said so in this crazy book that nobody reads and nobody understands, it said so. Now, you have to be bound to that. If you want to have an adult relationship, you have to bind yourself to this crazy book that you didn't write, nobody that you knew wrote. You can't talk to anybody who wrote it. You don't know who wrote it. Nobody knows who wrote it. Nobody knows exactly when any of it was written, by the way. Nobody knows what particular events most of it is talking about. Most of the events in it have no relationship with history at all. At all. This is the moral guiding center compass of our House of Cards universe? Really? Yeah, really. Because it justifies anything. Justify anything in that book. Maybe we should be reading the Tao Te Ching. Who knows? Maybe we should read the Tao of Pooh. We'd be nicer people. Anyway. We now have to go to this crazy book to justify our relationships. Because this crazy book says somewhere in there that it never actually says what we say that it says. It doesn't say that men and women have to get married forever and never look at anybody else. It says that women are dogs and slaves and they have to do what their male owner says. This seems to be an idea that would upset half of the population at any given moment. So why do we care? It was a particular tribal period of the world in which women were the property of the house bund, the house binder. Okay, great. Do we want to do that anymore? Do we want to live that way anymore? Really? Most women would say no, but women in power always say, yes, I support that book. Women in power always say, yes, I support that book. It's a good book. But they don't want to be slaves. They want to be Hillary Clinton. They want to be dominating testosterone testicles, dropping nuclear bombs on anybody who looks twice at the falafel lands of the Middle East that are our friends versus the ones that aren't. Okay. We have to go to them to justify our relationships and say, okay, I swear in front of you middle-aged perverts, you rapist popes, you crusade-driving, psychopathic serial killers who sent hundreds of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people to places that they'd never been in search of relics which were all fakes, to kill people who had no business visiting, let alone murdering. And we have to ask you for permission to love somebody, and if we don't love them the way that you say we're supposed to love them, because, well, there's a reason why. Now, why did priests have to be celibate? They weren't always celibate. You could follow the crazy teachings that you were reading from the Latin and Greek and be one of those people whispering to yourself and making jelly, and you could essentially run a brothel or something like that out of your nunnery or out of your monastery. It happened all the time. And that was fine for a long, long time. But then somewhere in the 1100s, the Pope, and I don't know if it was a Pius, I can't remember, one of the early popes said, oh, you priests can't have kids, because if you have kids, then your kids get some of your property. And that's our property. That's the church property. Think about it. So priests had to not have kids and then not get married and not be sexual at all, which sent them right in the direction, right, of the confessional booth where they got anything that they wanted. Now, somewhere in early 1907 or so, the Pope of that era decided that young children needed to go in for their first confession, not at 13 or 14, a coming-of-age year, but at 7. Yes, they had to go confess mortal and venial sins at 7. Yes, Father, I thought about... Okay, so now priests who haven't been able to marry or have the sex that they wanted to have for whatever it was, 800 years, now have a captive population, and we know how that turned out. And only decades later are we able to talk about it in hushed voices. We have to go to these people who created hatred of homosexuality, hatred of heterosexuality, hatred of all sexuality, to get permission to care about somebody. And if we don't do it their way, we're met with infamy and scorn. Now I promise the state. Here comes the state to manage the rest of you. Based on a book that has no known writers, that isn't a book, that's a collection of superhero stories from a variety of cultures, reinterpolated over time, rewritten from language to language, so that words that are very important words, like young woman becomes virgin, and so all of Catholicism is obsessed by virginal girls? Fuck. God. God. Sorry, but it's such a nightmare. It's so draining to have to deal with the mindset that comes about and takes mistranslation seriously, or takes any old comic book seriously as a way to absolutely live. Why don't you live by Gilgamesh? Why don't you try to live by the Odyssey? It's a more interesting book, and it's more honest about the way people are. So the state comes along and says, well, the church says that these are the rules because here's the superhero book, and we don't know if it's true, and you can't teach it in school, but you got to get married according to what they say. Yes, if you want to have a relationship, and it's going to be a successful relationship, you have to get married their way. Or you can go to our city hall and sort of get married their way, but it's more or less the same thing. Now, if you want to build a tribe, if you want to have a large extended family, if you don't want to live in a single family home, if you want to risk flirting here and there, if you want to open your relationship a little to the prospect that both of you are human beings who enjoy a flirt here and there, who have other affections, without running around and being, you know, without being slut-shamed all the time. Oh my God, you find people attractive, go kill yourself. The devil loves you and God hates you. Oh, you're only supposed to find people attractive between the ages of, well, we're not sure, and what sure, but sometimes between divorces you can also find people attractive, but never during a relationship, only the person who you're supposed to find attractive, even though you don't really, so come to counseling, and go to counseling with a priest, because he'll set you straight. You now have to go to the state to get permission to have the relationship, and if you screw up at all, you have to suicide yourself. Suicide the love, suicide the friendship, all in the name of the means of operating your soul and psyche that you signed up for, that you weren't smart enough as a kid to reject. You're not clever enough as a kid to go, what? The guy laid down with the lions and nothing happened because he believed in what? Is that true? Because if I told you that happened to me, you'd tell me I was lying. What? A guy had a fish and then he had a few thousand fish? Get the fuck out of here. No, he didn't. What you talking about, Willis? No, he didn't. Isn't that clearly a story? Doesn't that just... But didn't they have prequels to that in the old... I mean, weren't there prequels to that? If you actually are going to be a biblical scholar and you read the Talmud, the Torah, it's just a set of prequels. It's a set of sequels and prequels. Well, Christians get around this by calling it prophecy. So a story that's been around for 800 years, when it's rewritten, those stories aren't prequels, they're prophecy. It's a magical way of thinking like a true Christian. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Bang, bang, bang. Right against the head. Knock, knock, knock. So we're stuck in this world. And look, the Hebrews and the Muslims, and, you know, there are very few fundamentalist Hindus, because Hinduism is just too wild to take that seriously. But they get us with stuff when we're young that we're not able to think about critically. And that matters. Now we're older. We should be able to think critically without thinking that we're tempting our own eternal soul for not believing superhero books that were written millions of years after the dawn of the, as far as anybody can tell, the human species anyway. It's like saying something that happened in 1983 is the most important thing that ever happened in the human species because you remember it, or somebody told you that it was. It's not true. We are controlled by many mechanisms, by many levers, and I'm just trying to point a couple of them out to you with a few jokes and a little critical thinking. My name is Liam Sheff. This is American Heretic. My name is Liam Sheff. This is American Heretic. My book is Official Stories. Please put a couple dollars into PayPal. See you next. Think for yourself. my parents are listed in the Guinness Book of World Records as the most needlessly bloody, heinous, long-lasting divorce of 1973 through 79, 80, whenever it actually ended. I was there for all of it. I witnessed all of it. I was, you know, there in the lawyer's offices, if not dragged to court. I suppose they just managed to avoid that. There are a number of reasons why it happened. I'm going to tell you about those. My name is Liam Sheff. My books are Official Stories and The Truth About Love. This is American Heretic, supported by you. So if you enjoy these messages, please put 5 or 10 or whatever you can afford into the PayPal with my thanks. Now, my parents met at a swimming pool. That was the story. My father asked to borrow a newspaper. I suppose my mother wasn't bad looking, but she's my mother and I've never really... But he found her appealing enough to read whatever she was reading. I don't know, New York Times, probably, being blue-blooded. My father is very Jewish, or was, but lapsed. And so because he was a doctor and an MD in training at that point, his religion wasn't really the religion of the Torah, but rather the religion of Latin and memorizing bits of bones and cadaver and medical advice. He was on his way to becoming a pediatrician in Baltimore, going to Johns Hopkins. My mother is an incredibly bright woman, probably genius level in some areas, with some emotional issues, an inability to look at certain issues, especially maybe her parent, her childhood. She had been turned into a younger mother to her brothers by her mother and was robbed of a great deal of her will, I think. And there were problems there. And my father had problems too. I think that he was abused growing up. He, early on, evidenced a kind of flashing temperament you might call mercurial, maybe a little bit borderline, with real flashes of violence when I was young. And I experienced that. My mother experienced that. They started not getting along at a certain point. They were separated, fighting. It happened after his father died. He became, I think, very moody and difficult and very confused about where he was going in life. He had married a shiksa, or maybe, maybe not. My mother's family pretends they're not Jewish, but they're about half Jewish. My father's family is Jewish, but sort of is just so secular it doesn't matter. And I grew up thinking I was Christian, if that makes sense. I even went to Catholic school for 2 years. They wouldn't let me take the wafer, though, because I hadn't been baptized. I was going to make a Catholic joke and say molested, but unfortunately that's not true either because I was around Catholics. Thanks, Catholic. Thanks, Catholicism. Thanks. Yeah, that's a video for another story, a story for another video. But, all right, back to the divorce. So they end up fighting. I'll get back to it, I promise. I'll tell you everything. But back to the divorce. So they start not getting along, and then they separate. And then my father's going through his thing with his dead father and the ghost of what he was supposed to do. And I think the violence he suffered, the ridicule that he suffered as a very sensitive child, probably somewhere, maybe on the Asperger's spectrum, maybe. Because he's intensely bright and very good with words, but his emotional vocabulary is severely lacking. And I think that he encountered a woman who sort of took him and managed him. And I think that that's really what he wanted at that point in his life, to not have to feel and not have to think. So he met a woman, coal black eyes, chain-smoking, anorexic, bulimic disaster from some coal mining pit in Pennsylvania, probably having been passed around by a number of abusive uncles or whatever. Fine, you know, I never understood the appeal of her, but he did. And the story is that she threatened to kill herself if he didn't go with, but they were already screwing and stuff like that. So he went with her, who managed his psyche better than my mother, who didn't and is difficult. My mother's very argumentative and difficult. And he wanted somebody to probably just take his side in every fight, flatter him, make him feel good, and slowly squeeze the money out of him for a better and a better and a better house. And that's where he lives now. Good job, David. They've gone through their whole lives being a couple that just spirals down into this constant internal maelstrom that only they understand. He's always been afraid that everybody was after his money, so he didn't give his first child support. That's the kind of guy that I had to have as a father. Total disaster. Total disaster. Episodes of real violence, followed by, I'm sure, sorrow. He stopped being violent after he pushed my half-brother down the stairs at a public pool. If I said that already, I apologize. But then he stopped. You're not supposed to be a pediatrician to be extraordinarily violent. You're getting the picture. Childhood was not rosy. It was very difficult. My father is an asshole. But you would never know it by meeting him because he's kind of self-deprecating is the word. Self-hating is actually what it is. And laudable, you know, good job. You're a great pediatrician. You've injected thousands and thousands of kids into our Chester with vaccines, you fuck. And never bothered to read about them, you lazy fucking bastard. So that's that side of the family. My mother's side of the family has their own scourge, you know, they're sort of too internal. They take after the sort of Germanic thing of my grandfather, which I think is Germanic, it's probably Czech or Austrian or something of my grandfather, you know, not very emotionally expressive. And they totally ignore the Jewish side, the Jewish heritage that they have that's entirely expressive and emotional and evocative. And for whatever reason, it seemed to pour all out in me. So I'm the kid who was born going, hey, you know, why aren't we all talking about our feelings? And they're like, we don't talk about our feelings. So I grew up in among people who didn't know how to communicate. And they didn't know how to prioritize. And it was a burden, and it was a bother. It was really hard, because I've always been so open. So I learned to communicate by trying and struggling to express things. And I saw this divorce happen, which is the moral of this little episode. I saw this divorce happen. And I saw people hating each other who had once fucked each other and liked each other or at least found each other tolerable and interesting. And I just saw them hate and hate and hate. And my father was, of course, driven by the wraith succubus that, you know, he has on his side to this day. And my mother's in her world of denial and, you know, refusing to take some responsibility, which would have helped a little bit, maybe. And just feeling attacked and being such a strong Aries, you know, just pushing back, pushing back, pushing back. And I was just thrown under the wheels of the carriage because she had to go back to medical school. She didn't have to, but she went back to medical school to sort of please her parents who were displeased with her for having married the Jew who represented everything about themselves that they didn't want to deal with. I swear, God, it's from a John Cheever novel. Funny enough, he's my great uncle. All right. There are options besides incredibly bloody divorce, though. The other option is, of course, staying together. Now, if my parents had stayed together, my father, being violent, would have hit my mother and hit me. Well, he did. And that would have been bad. So maybe it was good that they got divorced, right? Maybe, maybe not. Staying together for the kids, if you don't really get along, is problematic because you don't want to fuck each other. You don't want to have sex. You don't want to talk and hang out and be each other's so-called best friends and all that other stuff. You might like other people. There should be a third option, shouldn't there? Instead of bloody massacre divorce, it's all your fault, I hate you, let me find somebody else to wrap my wounds in, that's my father. My mother didn't find somebody else to wrap her wounds in, to her credit. She did find work to wrap her wounds in. She had a wounded ego, and she went and found something that was worthy of her skills. Unfortunately, it wasn't. You know, it was just medicine and sitting in the dark basement doing radiology, nuclear medicine. A waste of her talents, really. She's intensely bright, very creative, and really much more of in many ways, more of a, if not an artist, then an art historian. She was a good pianist, could really play well. And I always sort of fantasized that she should be a teacher at some sort of, you know, boarding school dealing with the arts and dealing with education. But alas, her ego or her fear of being a little bit poor drove her back to the family business, which was medicine. Problems all around. I suppose this is more of a confessional video than it is a video about how to communicate better or choosing a third option in a divorce, but so be it. It sets the groundwork for other conversations, so you know where I'm coming from. An important concept in not getting along, though, is in remembering what your priorities are. And once you have a child, that is your priority as a couple. It is not fucking. It is not being best friends. It is simply the child. It is not your new girlfriend or boyfriend. It is not your sex life. It is just the child. Now, that said, you don't have to pretend that you still want to fuck each other or even pretend that you're going to be married forever in order to take care of your children. This is something that's not presented to us when we go to the counselor, or God help you, the divorce lawyer. They don't say, you guys could just get along and sort of be separated for a few years and be very supportive co-parents. And you don't actually have to sue each other for divorce, and you don't have to split up the property, and you can still sort of share a house, and the guy can go get an apartment if he really feels horny. The mother's probably just going to want to take care of the kid for a while and feel supported. You could do that. We could allow women, we could just sort of have homes for well-educated working women who are raising kids together so that they could raise kids together and not have to deal with their alcoholic, semi-violent, ridiculous louts who, you know, can't prioritize in their lives and be decent fathers, even though they want a little extra freedom or something, some extra sexual license or freedom. Because we lock ourselves into this illusionary, this totally illusory monogamy in which we pretend that we're, you know, going to be into one person only for the rest of our lives. It's not that you couldn't be into somebody for the rest of your life, but the idea that you're only going to find one person interesting for the rest of your life is absurd. We're such complex creatures. We need people to reflect our multifactorial personalities to us. You know, we run this gamut of personality types even within one person. We need somebody to reflect. We need a variety of people to reflect those things to us. So why do we go home and pin it all on one person? And then when it doesn't work out, we go, oh my God, we failed. Let's kill the children. Let's go to divorce and split up and move 600 miles away and never see, let the kids see each other except by going on trains and airplanes and feeling lonely and isolated. Why? Why? You didn't hate each other forever and ever. You liked each other to screw and to get along and have many good conversations. Why imagine that you failed just because you don't want to do all of that all the time? Maybe you're actually still turned on by each other and you almost resent that because you don't get along very well. Maybe it would be easier to admit that you still find each other, that you still fancy each other sexually, but you just don't get along very well. Wouldn't it be a relief? You know, we just don't fucking get along very well, but I'm just so hot for you sometimes. Could we figure out how to be friends and not feel that it was cheating if we had some other friends who helped us feel more heard, so I don't want to strangle you when you're sleeping? This, you know, this happens among men and women all the time. Can we just have some other friends who make us feel heard, who make us feel psychologically valuable? Because you're so bitter, drinking all the time, coming back home from the job that you hate to throw money at us because you hate talking to us. Could you just go out and have a little bit of extra fun without getting 20 people pregnant, without thinking that you're going to abandon us because you are having a slightly better... Good, have a better time out there, but remember, you made this responsibility, be tribal about it. It seems to me, I know I'm just one guy with this, you know, difficult parents that I grew up with, so what do I know? Maybe I know a lot. Maybe experience tells me, excuse me, maybe experience tells me a way to do it, that people who had passably reasonable childhoods in which the couple sort of kept it together a little bit, but really have their own hobbies in their own lives. Maybe my childhood, being the biggest disaster that I've ever heard of, for the most part, outside of a Dickens novel, should essentially be a template for everything not to do, but for how to fix things. You don't have to get the bloody divorce. You don't have to wrap your wounds in the new person or the job. You could actually decide that it was okay not to be madly in love anymore. It's okay. You haven't failed. It's all right. We're not going to be one thing forever and ever. We're not getting along, and that's okay, because we're going to pay the bills, and we're going to take care of the kids, and if you need to have a girlfriend or a boyfriend, go do it. Schedule it. Let's keep raising this kid, and maybe one day we'll actually learn and remember why we really liked each other enough to be friends. Wow, what an idea. Friends raising kids. Friends raising kids. What a nightmare for the divorce court system. What a nightmare for the American marriage trap and the Catholic Church that gets off on watching us all squirm while the priests get away with murder. My name's Liam Sheff. My books are Official Stories and The Truth About Love. If you enjoyed this uncensored, unbridled, unrestrained psychological portrait of a person being very honest about the way the world works, please thank me by putting a couple dollars into the PayPal. The links are... Or buying a book. If you enjoy it, tell me what you think about it. I'm there on the Zuckerberg website from time to time. You can find me and give me some feedback. Let me know what you'd like to talk about. Share your parental divorce stories or how you think we could do it better. Thank you. In about 5 years, American cities, if we're lucky, will look a lot more like Vietnamese cities. They will be full of bicycles and twin-stroke diesel engines getting 60 to 100 miles to the gallon. They'll be full of pedestrians and people walking and moving around in any way that they can. There will be animals being farmed and gently herded in the backyards. People will be growing food anywhere that they can. Food will be the primary article of sale in any downtown or any suburban square. Plastics and electronics will be items that occasionally come in. Refurbishing of material will be much more important than buying new material. Now, how do I know this? Am I a wizard of some sort? Do I have a time machine that I get into? No, I'm paying attention to something called economics and something called history. This is something that you're discouraged from doing by both politicians on the one side, the corporate media on another, and then if we have a square on the other side, we'll have the conspiracy group. If we have a triangle, then we'll, on the other side, we'll have a conspiracy group. In 5 years, the American downtown, if it still exists, the American suburban square, the American supermarket parking lot, will look much more like something you would see in an Afghani bazaar, an Egyptian marketplace, or a Vietnamese downtown. The primary article of exchange will be food. The primary means of motion will be feet, bicycles, and twin-stroke, noisy diesel engines beaten up and being repaired constantly. Electronics will not be new, but we will be constantly refurbished and fixed and sledged together with a little bit of whatever can be soldered together that doesn't totally fail. People will sit with computers with long lines so that you can still get on the remaining crypto internet so that you can send emails on occasion. I predict that in 5 years you'll see a lot more of this, and I think that in 15 years this will be the new norm. How do I know this? Why do I think this? Because I pay attention to two things that we're discouraged from thinking about. One is history and one is economics. My name is Liam Sheff. My book's Official Stories. This is American Heretic. Now, you say 5 years is an awfully short period of time, Liam. Yes, but go to the countries that I've named. Go to the bazaars of the Middle East. You'll find exactly what I'm talking about. Go to the city centers of places that aren't as rich in stolen oil as we have, and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. Internet cafes with lines, people on time limits able to send emails, where the primary article of exchange is food, locally grown, locally procured. Animals will be all over the place. Goats, chickens, sheep, rabbits, ducks, a variety of birds that lay eggs, a variety of birds to eat, lizards, insects, reptiles edible reptiles, you understand what I'm saying, fish. Anything that can be procured will be. People will be growing food in barrels. They will be growing fish in buckets and barrels. Won't be that healthy, but they'll be doing it. People will be trying to grow greens and other kinds of plants inside of cities. They'll have some luck, but if the electricity runs out, they'll be deeply, deeply fucked. And it won't be going well for them. So there will have to be a reinvigoration of old parking lots. They'll have to be torn up, the blacktop taken off, and the soil beneath revealed to the sky. Those will have to be invested with dead, rotting plant and other materials to create new soil. This is all going to have to happen in fairly short order. Why? Because we're going to be living in a lower energy society. Now, again, the mainstream media, the mainstream politics, and even the conspiracy mythicists online don't want you to think about life having to be lower energy. But it's what we have to think about, or we're going to die because of an infection. That infection is with that terrible, terrible H virus. Yes, the hope virus will stop us from thinking critically about what happens in every society around the world when energy goes lower. The only antidote to the hope virus is the P vitamin, the planning vitamin. Also the R shot, the shot of realism, wherever you need to take it. realism and planning will get you to understand that oil is not a renewable resource. Certainly it is not renewable in any way that anybody can demonstrate. It is also not renewable or discoverable at the 90 to 95 million barrels a day that we use. Nobody has discovered new fields at that level for a long, long, long time. The fields that were once discovered at that level were used to build America in the 20th century. There is a reason why America in the 20th century looks different than every other period of human life on any continent on this planet. It's because we had a slave called oil. We found it in abundance, and we used it without forethought. We used it without vitamin P. We didn't plan a long-term use of the stuff. We just assumed that we would find more and more and more and more. And so we went around the world. We, the Western states, we, the oil states, we, the people with guns, at the heads of the poor people of the world, found oil, took it, used it up, it's gone, and now we're down to the dregs. We have a lot of dregs left, don't get me wrong. We have the burning tar sands of Canada, we have the dregs of the Permian Basin, we have the dregs of the shale rock, very expensive, very hard to get. Now, why will the world wind down and look more like a marketplace from another country? Why will we be stuck in an environment that no longer resembles the cart and go, park your car, get anything you want, any time of day society that we live in now? Why will we have animals growing all over the place, being raised all over the place? Because that energy that we use to put food as far away from us as possible, to put the drudgery of farming as far away from us as possible, won't be available for any kind of cheap price. It will be hoarded by the military and the small industrial sector that still requires it to fund a military. You can bet that the military will hold on to the remaining oil long before it runs out and long after the rest of us have easy access to it. You know that they'll have the best weapons, the best machines, they'll have the guns, and we won't be able to take their oil. We could try, we'll just get shot or lit on fire or something like that. So we'll sit out there like the ancient serfs sat outside the castle in Mycena to anywhere in feudal England. The serfs lived outside the castle walls. Inside the castle walls they had the butter and bread and honey to spare. Outside they had turnips and a little bit of what they could milk or steal or grow. You see the feudal world then returning, but with oil at the concentric center of the feudal society. There is absolutely no way around this. Now, the conspiracy mythicists and conspiracy idiots out there who are immune to history and imagine that we can remake ourselves as a species by crossing our fingers and saying, I do believe in fairies, I do believe in fairies, that we can have cars that run on angel farts or whatever you think the Rockefellers are holding back, are in for a very, very, very hard landing and a difficult wake-up, as are, by the way, we all, including me, sitting here looking at the traffic, looking at the artificial water, looking at, the artificially pumped water, looking at the artificially watered grass in the desert of California. I've got to get out of here the same way you got to get out of where you are, or start growing food there. We're all in for a hard landing. But the future is futile. It's futile, and if we're lucky, it's slightly pluralist rather than being ridden hard by popes and prelates on the Jesus bandwagon trying to control our minds as much as they're controlling our food source. Of course, the reason that they reach in to control our minds is because it's very difficult for us to give up our freedom unless we're scared of eternal damnation. That's the real purpose of religion, you know. Manage people by shaming them, usually about their normal sexual impulses or their desire to care about other people, their desire to get along. Shame them on those grounds, infiltrate and spread and sow doubt and fear among them. And it's not hard to do. You have to admit it's not hard to manage people based on these small switches that you can flip in us. It doesn't take a great thinker to say, hate your enemy because the devil is in them, and the rest of us go, okay, we'll do it, whatever. It's not the people in charge who make us assholes, it's the human species itself that is primarily a bunch of feudal, tribal assholes. And that's where we're headed. If you wonder if there's a positive message here, it's that you're going to have to prepare for it. Instead of saying, what can we do to change it, you know, sort of the liberal mid-20th century American standby, how do we change our nature? We don't. We don't change our nature. You have to accommodate it. You have to know and admit to yourself that our energy solvency, that our energy future is darker than our energy past, that we're going to have a more difficult time procuring all of the things that we're now very used to not having to think about at all. If you prepare for it and you decide that part of life is going to be the growing of fields and the procurement of food, it becomes then part of life, and you don't necessarily have to be bullied into being afraid of everything that comes around, and you're not going to be susceptible to the mind traps of the conspiracy mythicists or the political mythicists, both of them. On the one side, you have the politicians promising you more jobs at, you know, meaningless shit that can't be done because we won't have enough cheap oil, and then you have the conspiracy mythicists telling you that Tesla energy and angel fart-powered cars will come and we'll be able to live this way, but there'll be no pollution and everything will smell and taste like vanilla because that's your favorite thing. So, in the real world, we have energy, and we either have enough of it, too much of it, or not enough of it. We've had too much of it, and we built a very, very destructive machine for a long time. We've invested in nuclear power, nuclear bombs, we've dropped bombs and nuclear radiation all over the world, nuclear waste all over the world, we've made kajillions of tons of plastics, which is sitting in the variety of oceans and various oceans. We've produced artificial fertilizers to destroy the land and destroy the water. We had too much energy. We're going to be dropping down to having less. Now, whether it's too little energy to survive is not known. Certainly, it's too little energy to make this system, which requires too much energy to survive. And that's not a small point. Our system requires so much energy to keep going, to run all of these cars that you hear in the background that I'm watching. These highways full of cars all day long require the energy, or the cars don't exist. They don't move. So this system goes away if the energy requirement dips down below a certain amount. You can't run cars, you can't get the resources around a country if you only have 50% of the resources. Everybody doesn't end up with 50%. It doesn't work that way. It's feudal. It goes to the central mass, the most powerful owners, and they get it. They don't control whether gasoline exists or not. They control whether they get it first or not. And that's a mistake that the conspiracy mythicists make. They actually think that the people in charge are really in charge. They're consumers too. And maybe that's one of the most important things to understand that you don't understand, and that, you know, my friends out there in internet radio land don't understand. The people in charge are also consumers. So the only value, the only benefit they have from being in the 1% is that they're more buddy-buddy with the military-industrial complex. So they'll hold on to it for longer, but eventually it'll fade from them too. And they'll be feudal kings in feudal castles paying feudal guards and, you know, mercenaries to turn the swords on you if you don't, you know, give them a little bit of extra tax money, which is just, you know, money that they mint from metal, depending on how many turnips in your field grows and how many horses you have and how many goats you have at the end of any growing season. We're a very feudal species. We're a very tribal species. And feudalism is just a kind of grand extension, in a slightly negative way, to be honest, of tribalism. But in any tribe, everything is shared. And in every feudal society, everything is shared. The problem with a feudal society is that at the time that it gets above a certain level of armament, it's always being raided, and so they have to build walls and they need a militia. Tribal societies aren't quite as pugilistic as industrial societies. Or you could say that they fight more but with lower consequences. Some of their fights are more, they're almost more play than ours. They're almost more for sport. Nevertheless, we're a feudal species. I'll continue to talk about this. My name is Liam Sheff. This is American Heretic. See you next time. Put a couple dollars into the feudal PayPal. Thank you very much. You're suffering from a belief that because you grew up a certain way, your world is going to stay the way that you remember it, or get better. As Howard Jones once said, things can only get better. I'm here to tell you that's not true at all. My name is Liam Sheff. My books are Official Stories, The Truth About Love. This is American Heretic, funded by you, if you care. to put a couple dollars into the PayPal. Thank you. Now, can things only get better? If you were born in the 20th century after a certain period, let's say 1940, to you the world looks like it can only get better. This is an illusion caused by one thing. Do you know what that thing is? I'll give you a hint. It's oil. Oil came to us in large volumes in the 1930s. We used it to win World War II. The United States provided 6 of the 7 billion barrels of oil used to fund and win that war. We were 6 out of 7 barrels of oil in World War II. That ain't nothing to sneeze at. So how did we do it? We had East Texas oil, we had Oklahoma oil, we had California oil. All of that has been precipitously on the decline since 1970-71, when the United States peaked in its oil production and began to go down. The oil shocks of the 1970s are a sign of what's going to come our way. The reason we had oil shocks in the 70s is because we no longer had the oil that we needed to run our society, because our fields weren't producing as much no matter how many wells and derricks we sunk. Chinka, 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 doesn't matter how many you sink, you're getting less. The ground isn't playing politics with you. It's not the free energy machine turning its back on you. This is strictly petroleum geology, something that people on the internet don't want to know anything about. They want to live in conspiracy mythology land where vanilla and chocolate-scented angel farts power free energy flying cars. Back in the real world, where people have to go do dangerous, deadly work drilling into the ground to dredge up sticky, noxious stuff that is stuffed into the pores of sandstone and limestone under intense pressure until that pressure is released, at which point the stuff has to be actively pumped out using a great deal of energy, huge volumes of energy to pull the sticky remaining oil out of the ground, and it gets worse and worse and worse. That's where we are and have been for a long time in the United States. It is now, apparently, where the great oil-producing countries of the world, Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, are too. Their oil is heavier, it's getting stickier and thicker. Saudi Arabia has been flooding its oil fields with seawater since 1965 just to push the pressure up in those sand and limestone reservoirs. Now, if you don't know anything about petroleum geology, and, you know, most people don't, then you think that our society has gotten better because people have gotten to be more liberal or mindful. Nothing could be further from the truth. We've become more liberal and more mindful because we had a lot of oil. We didn't get more energy because we were more liberal and more mindful. The ability to become liberal and mindful means that you have more free time and you don't have to work as hard for the stuff that you have. Liberalism is a product of bounty, not of efficiency, but of overindulgence. The more you have, the more liberal you can afford to be. The less that you have, the more conservative that you have to be. This is not a small point, but this is left out of every economic, geopolitical argument made by anybody that I've ever heard. There's a very, very simple law, call it Liam's rule if you'd like, but the more stuff people have, the easier going they can afford. Hey, we've got a lot of stuff, don't worry, you can have some, we got plenty. If they don't have much, you find a society that forms very, very hard and punitive rules. Islamic societies are hard environments, and look at their rule structure. It's abysmal and insane. Look at the ancient Judaic rule structure. It's abysmal and insane, and it's about a stone's throw or less from the modern hard Islamic rule structure. It's really not very different. It's a desert tribe living in a difficult environment without any energy to spare, actually in a constant deficit, that makes rules for how to manage people. So our liberalism in the 20th century came about because we had a surplus, a surfeit, an overindulgence of oil. And like a spoiled kid, we're stuffing our face, and a lot of crumbs fall to the side, and all the dogs and pigs and birds on the side can eat at the table. We're the dogs and pigs and birds, and the fat kid is the oil going into the maw of America. Where does this put us into the future? Well, we're running lower, and we have been since 1971. You wouldn't know it, though, because we became best buddies with Saudi Arabia, which should put to sleep the lie that we're friends only with democratic countries. We're only friends with countries that give us their oil. That's it. Lessons of an Economic Hitman, or whatever that was called, will tell you that story. as will the prize by Daniel, is it Juergen? Just read about oil. Read about the history of oil. You can even watch the good documentary series. I think it was, I can't remember. It was a PBS thing, something that they didn't screw up by having it funded by the National Science Foundation. But just the history of oil as it's progressed. Countries that would be our friends and let us, or England, put their imprimatur, our stamp on their oil fields were our buddies. And if not, we overthrew them like we overthrew the leaders of Iran. There's a reason that they don't like us. Like we overthrow the leaders of any Middle Eastern country, Gaddafi, anybody, who won't hand us their oil, Venezuela, Chavez. We're after the thing that makes society work. And at nearly 20 million barrels a day to make this stinking economy of ours work, and it's mostly used in stuff that we don't need to do anyway, so there is room for efficiency, but not efficiency that keeps Wall Street alive, and that's the next point that we'll make. We don't produce that 20 million barrels of oil a day. We probably produce 4 or 5. Maybe we could squeeze out 6. You'd have to look at the numbers. But imagine cutting this society into a quarter of its current size. I mean, imagine taking away 75% of all jobs. Imagine taking away 75% of all motor transport. I mean, if we actually had to survive within our means, and that 6 million barrels of oil, we can't actually get very quickly because it's mostly shale and crap from the Permian, from these other basins that are very hard to develop. It's very, very expensive oil, so it's not like we could even hold on to the 25%. Now, the conspiracy mythicists out there want us to believe in the angel fart-powered, free energy flying cars that will save us because we want them, because their imaginations are limited by their childhoods, and they grew up with cars, so they can't imagine a world without cars. Such is human stupidity, that it can't say that we don't always get what we want. But if we try sometimes, a great man, a skinny man, a funny man once said, you might get what you need. Now, let's turn our attention then, one moment. What was it that I said that I was going to cover? Hold on, I got to refresh the thought. Right. Let's talk about the thermodynamics of liberalism. If we're not able to procure that 20 million barrels of oil, nearly 20 million per day, to run this country, and we can actually maybe produce somewhere between 3 and 8, depending on your estimates, but really got to cut that down again, because we're getting a lot of that on the basis of the fact that we have an inflow of relatively cheap stuff from countries that are still relatively large producers, whereas we are not. You end up in a very different socioeconomic environment. Now, if we have to cut this many jobs and we have to cut long-haul transportation, that means that everybody in every city park and every suburban area has to make sure that they have enough water coming to their area so that they don't all go thirsty. We have to have enough water coming to a field so that we can grow food, and we have to turn parks and parking lots into fields of growing food. This immediately begs a problem, because Americans are adverse to hard work. We're a fat, lazy, brain-damaged country of video game-addicted, Mountain Dew-swilling hillbillies with shotguns or video game systems that we think that we're communicating with other people while we're sitting in our living rooms, our asses growing ever fatter, our diabetes getting ever more strident, and our denial of reality growing ever more looming and dangerous. So to motivate people to go outside in itself is a challenge, because we've all been terrified by the television and the reality shows that we're not supposed to get along with each other or trust each other or even form community anything. Because if we form community anything, we might run into the problem of, well, we'll start to break some of the Ten Commandments by flirting with people we're not supposed to. And our two-person economic marriage till divorce and pay the state a lot of money do you part farcical merry-go-round of infamy and hate will be disrupted and destroyed. So there's no way that the state will be happy about us going outside and farming. Nevertheless, we're going to get hungry, and somebody's going to say, there's a city park right over there. There's an empty parking lot. Let's tear that up and start growing food, because food is now $9 a loaf of bread and $2 a turnip, and turnips don't go very far. So let's figure this out. Somebody in City Hall will still have a heart and a brain and say, yes, you better start growing food. What happens, though, is that you see that old, terrible human habit. It's almost the inverse of the hope virus. It's the fear virus. Take over, and people will become S, the S virus, superstitious. So we've got the hope virus that tells us nothing is going to go wrong until it does, and then we've got the S virus, the superstition virus, which feeds religion. And people will go back in droves to the meaningless church and worship meaningless arcane figures that represent the sun, which they don't realize once represented the sun because they're so lost in the metaphor that they don't realize that really we should be worrying about nature much more than the four skinless Jewish something or other nailed to a piece of wood that didn't happen that makes us feel good if we just believe in it enough. We really actually have to get out there into the field and grow food with people. Now, what happens to liberalism? Oh, it dies a hard death, my friends. It dies a very, very, very hard, swift death. Because if you fuck up when we're growing food, you're out. You're scapegoated. You must have something wrong with you. The devil is in you. We'll perform an exorcism to see if we can maybe manage you into submission. But it's not going to be good for you. I can tell you that. When we don't have much, we become a small-minded, anxious, superstitious species. And I have to say to my friends, my good friends who turned back to old-timey religion now, you might be ahead of the pack. Maybe you will. Who knows? Because the rest of us are going to be catching up going, did we not worship you enough? Moloch, Baal, Yahweh, whoever the fuck it is, please make the food grow. We forgot how to do it. Oh, where's my video game controller to make the plants grow? This isn't Farmville. What am I supposed to do? How do plants grow? Son, what's that? Liberalism is entirely dependent on abundance. So liberalism, even more than conservatism, frankly, is dependent on the oil state, which is hilarious, because liberalism thinks that it's free to smoke pot and, you know, put daisies in the end of guns and swing around in the park and have a good time and be polyamorous and all that kind of great liberal stuff. Conservatism, on the other hand, is based in a misunderstanding of history. And that misunderstanding of history is that we're great because we're conservative or that we need high castle walls to maintain our intellectual moral superiority. Conservatism owes everything, just like liberalism, to having a shitload of oil. There are people who don't like outsiders. There are people who are more Babylonian in worldview, and those people tend to be conservative. They tend to buy into the old-timey religion because there's a certain amount of fear in it, and conservatives need a certain amount of fear, and they believe in a certain amount of fear, and they never let go of the idea that we might be able to get along with each other. And in some ways, they're not entirely wrong. In other ways, they're a bunch of, you know, killjoys and spoil sports and warmongers. So you have to watch out for both liberalism, which doesn't understand where it comes from. It comes from abundance. And conservatism, which doesn't understand where it's going. It's going to tyranny. There's no way to easily balance these scales. It's always a systole and diastole. It's always a heartbeat. There's no way to end taxation. I'm always amused by my so-called libertarian friends who suck at the oil teat the way the rest of us do, who refuse to pay taxes and go to every excursus, every far-flung destination in the world to hide a little bit of something instead of just paying, getting an accountant and paying 10% a year and getting 5% back, meaning they would keep far more by doing that than all the crazy shit that they do on principle not to pay the government something. You know, the ancient Jews who were run under the knife and gun, the knife and stone by the Romans did figure something out. They figured out that you can't fight the empire, not really. And when they rewrote Judaism in the somewhere in the first century BC, they came up with an idea, which is first century AD, which was, you're killing us all, so why don't we just pay taxes? And somebody wrote a line, render unto Caesar, which belongs to Caesar. In other words, if it costs you a quarter, even a quarter of a dollar, to let us live and have our community and have our version of God, we'll do it. It's not the worst idea in the world, and there's no getting out of paying some taxes, especially when there's so many loopholes if you find a good accountant. Liberalism, and by the way, that confiscatory taxation and that free society that doesn't take any taxes, there's no such thing as a free society that doesn't take any taxes. It's another heartbeat, a systole and diastole of a civilization that wants to survive. And there's always a push and pull. Lower taxes are good, but everybody pays into a state or a tribe. At the tribal level, everybody owes somebody everything. That's how tribes are bonded together. Everybody remembers everybody's debts, and nobody's ever really free of them. You just keep owing people stuff your whole life long. Between liberalism and conservatism, though, is the reality of this thing called oil. And it is to that that I'd like you to turn your attention as you look at your parks, neighborhoods, and backyards and decide to stop being a lazy video game slacker of some sort or another, either liberal or conservative, and to get busy growing food again. Do it. Worst thing that can happen is you lose a little weight and have some vegetables. What's the harm in that? See you next time. I want to talk about the idea of too big to fail. I want to talk about the Titanic, and I want to talk about pessimism. I want to talk a little about Greek and Roman history. I don't know how I'm going to wind that in. Oh, but Liam, say the conspiracy mythologist infected with the hope virus out there, you're just pessimistic. If you just believe, things will come to you. Well, all right, Tinkerbell fans, let's talk a little about pessimism and the other P, vitamin planning. It's the only antidote to the hope virus that most people are infected with. My name is Liam Sheff. My book is Official Stories. 10 chapters, 11 topics. CIA, JFK, vaccination, HIV, 9/11. Did I say that twice? Shakespeare, Big Bang, Darwinism, plate tectonics, and other science fictions, governmental fictions, political fictions. Go have a look at it. It's on Amazon for a song. You can read it on Kindle. This is American Heretic, funded by you. A couple dollars in the PayPal is much appreciated. So, am I a pessimist? No. Am I a realist? Oh, yeah, absolutely. How do you become a realist? You get slapped enough. You get hurt enough. And then you're like, well, shit. Let's read history. Let's figure out why these things happen. But Liam, you're such a pessimist. You don't believe that we're going to have a car that runs on fairy farts, angel farts, and hope. No, I don't. Now, why is it that I don't believe that we're going to have a car that runs on angel farts and hope? I'll tell you. But Liam, you're too attached to history. History's what's been, but the future is yet unmade. Let's talk about that also. And then let's talk a little about, well, what did I say this was going to be about? Pessimism. The value of a little good dose of critical thinking, which unrealistic people call pessimism. Okay, so what shall we start with? There was once a boat. It was called the Unsinkable. It was said that it was too big to fail. It went out to sea. It met its fate at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, North Atlantic. We all know it. At that point, Kate Winslet was fat enough not to die. She should have been in the water, really. I mean, you know, Leo was skinny then. He's not now. But the Titanic is famous, and it should be a famous bellwether for all of you who think that something is too big to fail. In fact, the bigger it is, the better chance it has of failing. Small, thrifty, low on the food chain, tends to survive. Just ask the dormouse. Just ask the cockroach. We human beings have become too big not to fail. And we're going to fail. Now, I have the internet full of people infected with hope virus, spinning mythology after mythology, oil wells that we will refill just because we want them to, technology that's being held back from us. Yes, we could just generate free energy out of nowhere. Tesla did it. No, he didn't, actually. Tesla invented energy that ran on Niagara Falls. That's what powered New York for a while in his alternating current engines. And then they burned coal. Tesla's machines are used all the time, so I don't know what you mean by free energy. Now, if you have to develop a device that runs on sunlight, that device isn't free. It's very expensive. You have to get metals from countries that don't want to have the metals taken out of them. You have to kill a lot of people to get the rights to those mines, and you have to enslave people in those countries to work in them while they get cancers from digging up the metals. That's not free either. Nothing in the way of free energy is actually free. There is a little bit of radiant electricity in the atmosphere, but guess what? It's not enough to kill you, so it's not enough to do anything with. It's a very weak, diffuse electrical charge. You could hypothesize that if you covered some great portion of a state with solar panels, you could fund the electricity for the state. But who's going to build the copper wiring, and out of what, and how much energy is it going to take to do that, to run those solar cells from the bright states all to the rest of the states and not have interruptions? Not going to be able to do it. Is solar a good idea? I ask rhetorically. Of course it's a good idea. It's a very important idea. But the most useful kind of solar is one that nobody talks about. It's just black plastic or black glass to heat up some water. You can do a lot with hot water. You can have hot water with hot water. And that's one of the most important things in the world. Just get your power turned off if you have an electric starter on your gas heater for a while, and you'll say, Jesus, God, hot water is fucking important. It's more important than the internet. I guarantee that hot water is more important than the internet. Try a cold shower for a couple days. I've done it. Try it. Internet, Schminternet, give me some hot water. Give me some black plastic or a black tar roof with water running under it. Now, that's the most important thing we can do in about half to two-thirds of the United States, but we're not doing it because we're all stuck on future mythology thinking. Now, I said I was going to talk about the problems and the way that we think. I wanted to talk a little about history. Let's go back to the Middle Ages, just for a second. The world ran on slavery. It ran on serfdom, which was a kind of slavery, and it just, in many ways, still ran on slavery. Serfdom in Europe replaced the outright slavery of the Greek and Roman varieties of empire, but there were still slaves all over the place. And serfs were slaves to a kind of king. You had to kick a little bit upwards so you could have a little bit of free time to get drunk and blot everything out of your mind with alcohol, which was the primary source of water at that point, you know, because a lot of water wasn't to be trusted, so you had to ferment it a little with some alcohol in it, which would kill the microorganisms. Yes, it was the great old days of being drunk all the time. Having about a third of the year being reserved for religious holidays in which you would screw and get drunk, you know, religion really had its purposes. So you can see that the Middle Ages were not all that we were are told they were. They were in many ways more leisurely than we were told, but in many ways just more tied to the land. And you had to kick stuff up, and that was it. Now, why am I talking about the Middle Ages? Because people don't realize that we're living in the Middle Ages with oil. We're still a tribal, hierarchical species that worships a king. We say we vote. We're just voting for a king or a queen who does the bidding of the dukes and the duchies and the duchesses and, you know, fends with the aristocrats to do what they want. But it's really about securing the energy source, which would be the serf labor, which would actually be oil. So in the Middle Ages, you had to manage the serfs. In the modern era, you have to manage the oil. That's the modern world versus the medieval world and the ancient world. In the modern world, we manage the oil. In the medieval world, we manage the serfs. If you went to a king, or even the serfs in the Middle Ages, and you said, you know, we could farm all this land if we just believed in free energy. That's very funny. That's very funny, Georg. Now get busy with that cow and that plow, because we need to fertilize that field, and we got to plant the corn and the barley corn, the rye for next year. We're not going to be able to have bread and get drunk. Okay, you're right. I'm amazed that people who believe in free energy don't look back at the Middle Ages. They wonder, they don't understand that their idea of a world that can have free energy is totally based on their having been born in an era with gasoline. So people in the Middle Ages believed in fairies that could, you know, and witches that could ride around in brooms and in pumpkins and that sort of thing, because they had brooms and pumpkins. And they saw birds fly and they just combined them. How great would it be to fly? Everybody always thinks that. And now people think, well, people can go down the road really fast in cars, so we should be able to have cars. We just see that as normal. It's not normal. It's totally abnormal. And it has infested your imagination to the point that your conspiracy mythology now believes that we have a right to have cars. It's not just a privilege or an accident of the oil age that we have cars. It's a right. So your mythology is now infected by the hope virus that says we can have cars, the same way that people in the Middle Ages thought that witches rode around on brooms and they accused women who were sexual or who were using special herbs or whatever of being witches. We now believe that there are a group of people who are stopping the free energy flying cars or rolling cars or whatever, hovering cars from existing, because we would like there to be flying, hovering cars that didn't use gasoline. Because we want it, we imagine that it must be, and that there's a bad group of devils holding it back. The Middle Ages told us there were devils tasking us all the time and making us want to have sex with somebody other than the person the Pope said we should, and so on and so forth. Is it any different? Not really. We're the same species. So why wasn't there a movement towards free energy in the Middle Ages? Well, there was. If you believed in Jesus, you would have a blessed life, and you would have better yet, after you left this world, you would have a great time. Heaven was all kinds of things, and Dante wrote all kinds of books about it. Heaven and hell. I mean, you could have a great time hither and yon, or you could have a terrible time. And his, by the way, the Divine Comedy and the Purgatory aren't quite tongue-in-cheek, but you can see the imagination at work on the little bits of scrap that come out of the Babylonian Assyrian myths that were processed through the through the Roman grist mill. Okay, so what are we talking about? The myth-telling practice that takes over the human mind. Why didn't they say we can have air-powered, water-powered cars in the Middle Ages? Because they'd never seen a car. But you know, they had other kinds of things that they imagined. So you have to know that you imagine this because you've seen Cars, and because your myth-making imagination wants you to hold on to Cars the same way that they wanted to hold on to life after death or goodness after death. They believe their myths and we believe ours. I know I've gotten a little off track. I wanted to talk about more things in this episode, but I'm afraid I'm suffering from a little bit of hunger. Let's take a little break and come back a little refocused, and we'll talk more about the, we'll see.
This is the Liam Sheff Show on UCY-TV Truth Frequency Radio. Please support the show by buying official stories at Amazon.